Hi, everybody. Hi, Sylvia. Hi, Kofi.
Hey, Laura and Sylvia. Welcome to Bookish.
Today, we're going to be talking about Rivers Solomon's book called An Unkindness of Ghosts. That's the book. Okay. And I think I'm starting us off today with introduction about the author and a little bit about the book itself. So Rivers Solomon graduated from Stanford University with a degree in comparative studies in race and ethnicity and holds an MFA in fiction writing from the Michener Center for Writers. They are from the US, but they currently live in Cambridge, England. And An Unkindness of Ghosts, the topic of our talk today, is their first novel. So An Unkindness of Ghosts was a finalist for lots of different awards, including the Lambda Award. But then Solomon's second novel called The Deep, which also has a really interesting premise, actually won the Lambda Literary Award in sci-fi and horror category last year, 2020. So before, I know we're going to get into a lot of, you know, talking about the novel itself, but I watched or read some of the interviews online. And one of the common things that I saw, and I'll throw it out there as part of an introduction about this author, is that when it comes to lots of different things, this author seems to really resist the idea of anything that's binary or categorizations, right? And so this applies to notions of gender, as the book explores, but also about books. So Solomon's books have been called a lot of things, including speculative fiction, which is sort of why I think we got into choosing the book. Also literary fiction, science fiction, dystopian fiction, and so on and so forth. And it seems in interviews, they resist this labeling, though they don't get mad about being asked about categories or labeling things. They entertain how each of those labels might describe their work. And it was so funny, in one of the interviews, they included among the things they like to see abolished, the gender categorization, as well as the fruit and vegetable dichotomy. So I thought that was really interesting. Like another example of something that we tend to sort of like to put in these neat categories. Solomon does not like that. Anyway, so that came up in quite a few of the interviews that I read and reviews where they talk about their work. So what did you think of the novel?
So just for our listeners out there, just like a quick synopsis or, you know, summary of the novel, like Laura just mentioned, I can totally see why it would resist categories, because it does sort of blend like sci-fi and spectral fiction and, you know, like elements of fantasy. It's just, there's a lot of things that are going on in the novel, but I was actually thinking about this as I was reading, like, how would I describe this, like, to a friend who's like, oh, what's that about? You know? And I thought, it's kind of like, I don't know, for those of you listening out there familiar with the Bong Joon-ho film Snowpiercer, starring one of the Chris's, I forget what his name is.
Chris Evans.
Yeah.
Sure. But it's like, you know where I'm going with this, right? It's like Snowpiercer meets like Star Trek, but in a dystopian Star Trek, like, you know, a racist, very racist Star Trek. So meets, I don't know, like any other book about like race and class warfare. And it's just, it's all of those mixed into one. And essentially it takes place on a large spaceship in the future called the Matilda. And in this ship is categorized by decks. And on the upper decks, you have like the upper caste or the upper class, which is white and wealthy. And then on the lower decks, you have the laborers, the slaves, the ones who are kind of forced into like this menial labor. And there's different like types of people on these lower decks too. So they're not all, you know, what you would just in your mind, or at least for me, you know, there's like different tribes, I guess, is a way to put it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the Tarlanders, there's like, you know, all these other types of people. They speak in lots of different languages depending on the deck that you're in. So it's really, really fascinating to see like this world that she's making come together. And yeah, and it's sort of about the struggle as they're searching for a new earth, because the one that they are leaving behind has been destroyed somehow. It's never really made quite clear how that's happened. And so they're like about 325 years away from their destination or whatever it's supposed to be, or they've been in space for that long. And so, you know, it's kind of like the self-sustained thing. Like there are fields on the deck. There's field decks where the workers go and work in the fields to produce crops and harvest. They have their own, what they call baby sun, a little like artificially made sun within the ship that, you know, replicates the energy of the sun so they can grow things, and they have like an ecology and an ecosystem there too. So it's actually really interesting the way that this world comes together. And then everything is controlled by the sovereignty. And so it's like a religious military state as well. So everything is by God's hand and like heavily controlled by the guards. So that's how I would describe it. And so it's this one, you know, this girl's story, this person's story in terms of like how they're trying to find a way out of this structured system that they're stuck into. And brief synopsis. I don't know if that was a good one, but.
Yeah, I read somewhere last night while I was sort of brushing through the book that it's like the antebellum South in the space.
That's a word.
Yeah, I kind of think it's more like a prison narrative
that's interesting. Yeah,
but it, you know, it's still hierarchical. And the reason why I say I brushed through, I feel like I didn't comb through the book as I might normally do, because there were so many things in it that I like where to land. So it's interesting how the author doesn't want things to be categorized. Yet that is the exact thing that is happening in the novel. Even at the end, one might argue there is a kind of closure, but also a category of that closure, in that I'm not gonna give the ending away, but you know, you come to realize that the protagonist Aster, is salvaging something from her mother and from her friend Giselle. And I don't know what category that is, but I'm assuming it's a category, because I think human beings, unfortunately, can't but categorize things. we don't know anything other way to describe things, because even if you use the word novel, that is a category of writing. So I understand why writers make these sort of statements, but they always ring a little bit incongruent in my ear. well, then it's nothing. So if I can't categorize it, it's nothing. And I know it's not that.
What I would say, maybe the way the author sometimes talks about these categories is the both and, rather than, you know, one or the other. Mm-hmm. I think maybe that's where this author is going with some of these. And I think you can tell that in, for example, the way the gender pronouns work in the novel, and how on a certain deck where everyone is assumed to have the she, her pronoun, like where Aster is from. And then as you go up to the different decks, and my impression was that the higher that we went on the decks, meaning in terms of class and getting whiter as we go up, that there was more intense, especially from the bad guys, the guards, homophobic and very clear, like this is a man and this is a woman. And if you don't belong to one or the other, there's this violence, right, that ensues or is inflicted on those persons who seem to not have a clear belonging to one of those categories. And I think that's what the author is doing too, in sort of saying like here it's much more fluid. And then I think, for example, Flick comes from deck where all the children especially are, they use the they pronoun, for example. So that was really interesting to see how those, even the gender question gets kind of lined up throughout the different decks.
And I think the sexuality, when it's among, you know, let's say when Giselle and Aster were young, they were playing house, right? There's a level of innocence, although Giselle may not have a level of innocence that Aster had, but when it's the guards, it's always physical violence. It's always sexual violence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think there is a critique being made there in the novel about women and their bodies and the body of a person in general, that it's almost always viewed through the category of sex, right? Yeah. And so you don't see personhood. And so that part in where the surgeon, I forgot his name.
Theo.
Theo Thackeray. That somehow another came with that. This idea that he was somewhat not a man, but not a woman. And there was this sort of misgiving, but his station, because of his relationship with the lieutenant and his service, made him valuable. And so even those on the lower decks, their service is what is valued, not mm-hmm. the person. And I found that just an interesting critique in how, you know, labor exploitation and those things, the work that we do is valued, but our personhood isn't.
And continuing on that train of thought, you know, when your personhood isn't valued, how then does that affect the way you view yourself? And throughout the novel, what I really took away from it was Aster is constantly viewing and then reviewing herself, you know, the yeah. way that others perceive her and what they say about her. And so, you know, in one scene where the lieutenant, who kind of controls the whole ship at one point, he has a very deep vendetta against Aster. You know, he despises her, is to put it lightly. And in one scene where the two of them are having a very tense kind of conversation, he compares her to his pit bulls. And he says that even his pit bulls are beautiful in the way that they look, but she's no better. What does that mean for her? That she's no better than a dog in the way that she looks. Mm-hmm. And then these words, like how they are then, and then she kind of, you know, she's a tough cookie. Like she has some moxie, this one, right? And so you think like she's impervious. You would think she would be impervious to these, like, you know, taunts and these like deep insults, but they're actually really, they are naturally really quite hurtful, and the right. way that they absorb into you and then inform the way you think about yourself as a person or less than a person. Yeah. I feel like that's a struggle that I see played out. Like, oh, she's trying to define herself, but she fits in no category, and she's not considered beautiful then or valuable according to any of these standards of these categories. And where does she belong and how does she view herself? And to me, like, this was something that was so, like, it was one of those things that came out to me so clearly in the novel and in different passages. And I want to read two very short ones for us. So there's one where she's then also being called, she dresses as a boy sometimes to travel between decks, and Aster can pass for either boy or girl. And so in one part of the novel, she's going to meet somebody and she's dressed as Aston, right, who is her kind of male alter ego. But even as a boy, like, you know, to some, Aston looks effeminate, right? Or like right. not fully like a boy, presenting like a boy. So they're insulting her as Aston. And so she says, Aster knew these insults weren't meant for her. She was playing a part. They hurt anyway. They hurt because of the people they were meant to target, and they hurt for all the ways she'd been targeted in the past. With everyone insisting it was true, it was hard to believe she was any good at all. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, that kind of a thought process is echoed elsewhere. And then there's this another scene not too long after that when she and Theo, who is also her like romantic interest, right, are together, and she's thinking of herself as she might be perceived by someone like Theo. And she thinks Aster occasionally, through no will of her own, worried she wasn't pretty enough and why. Pretty was a strange thing to concern oneself over. Pretty was subjective and fallacious. Pretty couldn't be replicated in a lab. She, as much as anyone, enjoyed the prismatic sweep of amaranth and bloom and the geography of animalian bodies. Yet when applied to people, it didn't jive with her that pretty was meant for some and not others. More pressingly, it didn't jive with Aster that some days she wanted to be one of those folks who was prettier than the other folks. It was like wanting to be more vanadium-based or wanting to have orange pigmented skin. Arbitrary, bizarre, pointless. Still, she wanted it, and Theo made her feel like it was already so. And kind of going to the idea of, like, you know, if you do have personhood, what makes you valuable as a person, you know? And in the upper decks, it's all about your appearance, you know, what color your skin is, the way that your bone features are. And I just thought it was so interesting that she's like constantly like negotiating these qualities about herself and like what she desires, like within these categories. And so it was really interesting, Laura, that you mentioned that she resists categories. As a writer, River Solomon, they resist categories, but she, Aster, is also at the same time the character is trying to navigate where does she fit in, you know, and using categories, kind of like what you said, Kofi, like using categories to try and understand that, but they don't work. They're, they don't like logically fit. And so to me, that was really one of the layers of the book that I really appreciated was questioning, okay, how do people perceive me? And what are those perceptions based on? And would I apply those perceptions to anything else, you know, in my world or in my life? And if not, then why do I want this to be perceived this way? Anyways.
No, that's great.
I think that's especially meaningful for Esther's character because so much of the novel is about her sort of having this tunnel vision, right? Or this goal of getting out or doing something. And she seems or appears to not care. She appears to not care about people, doesn't want to make connections and is on her own, has her own lab. And, you know, with the exception of the few people that she calls bunkmates, I think, right? And yet, as you say, Sylvia, you see her being pulled and she called it somewhere. She talks about how she doesn't like that she's become needy, that she has needs. And she, I forget, I think it has to do with Theo, actually, the sense of needing a person or needing a touch or something like that. So that she, no matter how much she resists it or wants to resist it, that she keeps getting pulled to needing people or having these desires or wanting to think about these things that she would like to think she's above or doesn't matter to her, right?
She resists some of it so much, you know, even the way that the way she feels about Theo and the way she behaves towards him.
Yeah.
You know, and partly because she's reacting to the way she's perceiving his, you know, understanding of her through his actions. And so I think at one point he describes their relationship as like acquaintances or friends.
Yes. Mm-hmm,
that's right.
And she gets so upset.
She does not like that.
No, and I laughed so hard and I was like, I was like, you know, like you, big no-no Theo, you know.
He's going to sleep on the couch tonight.
I know. And he's just kind of like, I was just being polite, like, you know, like I was just being like polite, you know, because he's very like formal. He's into formality and like being polite and everything. And no, she's not having that. And I just chuckled so much because I was like, in some ways, she's such like a normal young person who wants to be valued and who wants to be seen and validated, like openly validated, not like behind all of these like restraints, because there's always something there like that's preventing Theo from expressing his true feelings, or that's between her and Giselle, or even her and Loon, her mother, and even Aunt Melusine, who is the one person who just truly treasures and values her. And yet there's always like this block, I feel, that she's either unable to accept it or unable to be the one to like open that door for different reasons.
Yeah, I wonder about that in terms of her relationship with her mom, Loon. Seems predicated on those journals that her mom left in the secret lab. And it's really Giselle who unfolds a lot of this, or sort of decodes things that for whatever reason Esther couldn't do. So in some ways I was thinking, and again, I didn't comb through it, but I was thinking about the relationship of the word Esther to Hester, as in Hester Prynne. And there's this like stigma on her that she can't quite get out. I know it may be a stretch. I see the
Well, because I don't know about that. Okay, now I don't know, because Aster means like star, like she's named after like,
and Loon means moon.
Loon means moon, right?
Yeah. And so yeah, I get it. But I just wonder if there's this thing that is not necessarily an albatross, but there are these memories that the mother, you know, did something, and you know, I don't want to spoil things. And she left behind these journals and this sort of hidden room, and it becomes this sort of this other kind of space for her. Mm-hmm. And I think she is most free when she is in that space, or her lab, or the
botanarium,
and when she's with Giselle, because I think Giselle represents a kind of freedom and a kind of in your face that Esther struggles with, because I don't know if she's as free as Giselle in that way.
I definitely agree with that assessment, Kofi, because Giselle does what Giselle wants, and you know, she pays the consequences for them, you know, for those actions, you know, at the hands of the guards several times. But I actually, so, okay, one structural point of the novel is that you get to hear from everybody. It's mm-hmm. written in Aster's point of view for the most part, but at certain points you dip into Theo's point of view, and then mm-hmm. Aunt Melusine's point of view, and then Giselle's point of view. I was half expecting Loon's point of
view.
Yeah, I was actually surprised to see Giselle's point of view at the end, but I found it to be really helpful to get into Giselle's mind and really see the like depth and the extent to which she is free. You know, like she spends her life basically, like you mentioned, like kind of imprisoned on the ship and having to do, you know, other things. But like even within that, she finds ways to exert her own agency. And I thought that was why, yeah, like Giselle can unlock these different codes and understand things that Aster can't see, even though Aster is the smartest person on that ship for all intents and purposes. Right. So yeah, I would definitely agree with your assessment, Kofi, that Giselle is freer than Aster.
Yeah, and there's this one story that the aunt tells about the raven. There's two different ravens. One is a trickster, I would call, and the other is, I don't know if I want to say suicidal, suicidal. And I look at Loon and Giselle as those kind of ravens. Mm-hmm. And that one, I think Giselle is more of a trickster and Loon is desperate in trying to make things change, you know, steer the ship in a different direction. And maybe that critique and that idea of categorization is, you know, you really, either you're going to try to trick people or there's some type of interplay going on, or you got to go for broke and, you know, whatever happens, happens. You're going to take the consequences, you'll suffer whatever, but you got to change the ship. You got to change the direction, because this way is not the way. We can't be out in space for 300 something odd years. We gotta make a change. And I think when that unfolds, it becomes, there's a bigger point here. So
that story about the two ravens, it's an example of so many of the stories within the story. And it's such a big element in the novel too, that, and it's not just the stories that are told, but also then the stories that are in the journal that Aster mm-hmm. is trying to decode, but also sort of these like myths or imaginations they might have about this place called Earth, right, from 325 yes. years ago. And what's so interesting is like how the different characters latch onto these stories, and these stories of Loon, for example, too, right? Aster is trying to know what her mother was trying to do or what happened to the mother and so on and so forth. So there is this sort of like being guided, or you might even say haunted by stories, mm-hmm. right? And how these different stories, I really enjoy the stories, but I felt like also that was happening in the playing house between Giselle and Aster. But then once they got older, they got into theater and they're sort mm-hmm. of reenacting these imaginations. It's an imagination to them because the gender binary is very different on their deck, as opposed to this, they were trying to imagine what a husband and wife do, right? Yes. And it's actually very, a sitcom-y, like in terms of like bad sitcom-y from my perspective, where they have these stereotyped, you know, notions about, well, I'm the husband, so I'm about to hit you or something, right. Or you're the wife, so you have to be submissive. And these are probably the stories they know or they've heard from before, maybe before time, like Earth time, or how it exists in the other decks. And so there's so much of like the way they understand the world and their current present through the stories that happens. And I found that really interesting as the play thing that it went on for a while in the novel. Lots of stories being told.
I will say that the stories within the story feature, I would definitely agree, Laura. I saw like the idea of like a mythology built, like, you know, world building within the world building. And I think having backstories, but also like its own mythology is what makes like a culture unique, you know, having its own tradition of storytelling and passing those stories down. The raven story, I recognized immediately. That was interesting because a raven is a Native American trickster. It's, you know, mm-hmm. Coyote and raven. And now it's like, it's connecting with me with the idea of categorization, because Coyote and Raven, they, as tricksters are wont to do, really resist categories, you know, and they mess with all the ordered way of things. That's what makes them a trickster, you know. And that's interesting that the Raven, you know, flies away in this telling of one of the stories, flies away and comes back home after a long time and to find things that are totally different. And, you know, that sets off a whole series of events. But, you know, it made me think of the idea that maybe the role that Loon and Aster and Giselle play are all tricksters of some variety, you know, and their whole like purpose is to disrupt the ordered way of things. And that's what they end up doing, in their, each in their own way. And so I thought it was a really, just a really beautiful way to kind of weave mythology into it and also make them part of this sort of space mythology type of story. So yeah, I really enjoyed that element of this story. I think that's all we have time for today. And our next month's topic will be on fiction. In particular, we'll be talking about the ambiguities in fiction. So if you're one of those readers who like doesn't do well, speaking of messing up categories, if you're one of those readers who needs everything to be categorized and ordered and concretely explained in a story and really struggle when a story messes with that way of presenting whatever it's doing, tune in and we will be talking about that, ambiguities in fiction.
Indeed, indeed, because one question was, what made them unkind ghosts?
I was wondering that. I was wondering that too. Or no, the unkindness of ghosts versus a kindness of ghosts. Anyways.
Yeah.
And we didn't get into it, but the question of like, who is the ghost or what are the ghosts or the representation of that? I lost a little bit track of that in as I was reading, but I think somebody said there was so much in the novel. Right. So much to think about. So it was hard to keep track of some of like these threads. Yeah,
it was. And I don't do well with like scientific terms in novels because that's just not who I am. Like, I never thought I'd see the word stoichiometry appear ever again outside of like, but there we are, you know, it's a geometric equation. And I was like, no, my foe and nemesis. So anyways, on that note,
it was fun talking with you guys about the book. Thanks for reading along, and we'll see you next month. Bye.
Connect with us. We are Dragon Digital Radio.